Hello and welcome to Drivers Talk Radio. Engineer and co-producer Spencer here, letting you know that we're currently updating equipment, so this week we actually pre-recorded an episode a little while back of Rick and Jay sharing some stories growing up, and we're calling it Tall Tales. Now, enjoy the show.
Welcome to Drivers Talk Radio, hosted by automotive expert and championship-winning race car driver Rick Titus. Join Rick, co-host Jay Dalton, and their team for informative and entertaining discussions geared for automotive enthusiasts and consumers alike. Enjoy in-depth interviews with industry leaders and influencers. Now, originating from its studio headquarters inside Shelby American in Las Vegas, it's time for Drivers Talk Radio and Rick Titus.
And welcome to Drivers Talk. Rick Titus, Jay Dalton, and Spencer Crick. I just want to put a disclaimer in here right away. We're calling this Tall Tales. Is that what
we're
calling?
Tall Tales.
All right, here's the thing. For those of you who have watched this show or listened to the show for very long, this is our 16th season. You probably figured out that Jay and I in particular have pretty extensive and certainly intertwined automotive background. That includes a lot of family racing, a lot of team racing, being around motor racing, being around Shelby and Trans Am and Can-Am. We've been around a while, not to mention which the private testing we do for certain car companies, and in particular Ford, kind of the wild adventures we get on. Jay's experience with shipping things overseas, and that includes Africa, Japan, and Europe, and England.
Five decades worth, kind of overflowing here. And now we're going to put them in a pot and put the lid on and see what bubbles out.
All right, here's what worries me. Spencer was not involved in most of this stuff because he's just a punk young kid.
I'm just a punk young kid, man.
But I'm worried about how this information may get used.
Well, I want to make sure we stay relevant to these punk young kids here. You know, I want somebody who's 20 to say, that was pretty weird. that was pretty neat. But I think we can do that, don't you think?
I think we can make that happen. Now, I guess I'll kick the barrel open by starting with one of the earliest stories, quite frankly. And that, of course, is when we finally both achieved driver's licenses. And, of course, you decided that a little Mini would be a real fun way for you to go. So you end up acquiring, right out of the gate, a pretty unusual, not just a Mini for being unusual, but a pretty unique Mini on top of all of that.
This was a Mini Cooper, mm-hmm. and it came with a roll bar, and some of the paint didn't match.
Yeah.
And it was for sale by a man by the name of Shedenhelm.
Yeah, WRC Shedenhelm.
That lived down the street from you.
Yeah.
And he happened to live on the same street as your dad, Jerry Titus, worked for the same magazine.
Yeah, both
and lo and behold, this car came up, and I hear that from you, Rick, WRC Shedenhelm has this Mini up for sale. It's got a roll bar in it. Might be pretty good price. It was a Mini Cooper, not an S, a Cooper.
Right.
You know, 998 and CCs and not all that fast. But I thought, you know, we're talking about $1,000 here.
Well, here's the deal. I mean, my father's, at that time, the technical editor of Sports Car Graphic Magazine. I think WRC Shedenhelm was the feature editor, but I could be wrong. And he was racing in a thing called the Good Guy Sedan Series in SCCA, and of course this car was not only his street ride, but he would actually race this car on certain weekends. It had a roll cage and seat belts, and he would put on a little bit different tire for it, and off they would go. And it was kind of a famous photograph in Sports Car Graphic, the magazine both he and my father worked for, where it was up on two wheels sliding along at Santa Barbara. I think it did tip the rest of the way over, at least onto its side, did it not?
Yes, but I only learned this in a photograph
afterwards.
I owned the car. So I'm in high school. I've got this red Mini Cooper. I'm enjoying myself. I come to school in a roll bar, man.
That's right.
Five-point harness and a roll bar.
You're bad.
Absolutely bad. And then somebody brings the magazine to school and goes, hey, isn't this your car? It's laying on its side from an accident.
And
its first racing accident. Made the paper.
But this is how we were driving high school. I had a little Bug Eye Sprite, and one of our friends, Reese Libby, had a Porsche Spider.
Speedster. 55.
Yep. Jan Lutz had, a TR3.
Yes. Yes. And can you remember what Art Sonnen had? I can't remember.
You know, I can't remember
moment.
What Art Sonnen had.
But he went to a Fiat Abarth at one time.
But
as
I know Sonnen, I think, started out in his parents' Falcon.
I don't remember. But before we get lost in trivia,
yeah.
I do want to say that as long as we're in high school, mm-hmm. I'll jump right to my stories that I wrote down here because I can't keep them all straight anymore after 50 years of knowing you. Nevertheless, when we graduated, Do you know what I'm going to say?
I don't.
When we graduated...
I'm worried about it, but I don't know.
When we graduated... We had hung out in what was called the quad of the high school. Now, this quad was kind of this big open area and had some walkways running through it. We always looked at that quad and we said, wouldn't that be interesting to slide a car around some of these turns on the quads?
We used to say that.
So on graduation night, it is after dark, and at the time, the Mini was gone. Now I had a Lotus Elan.
Lotus Elan. Again,
not much more expensive.
Going for a ride with my father in a test car from Sports Car Graphic.
True. Absolutely true.
Came back, said, I got to get one
of these. I said, I'm getting a Lotus Elan, period. Saved all of my money from working at a gas station to get a used Lotus Elan that had been crashed in the front and had kind of a droopy mouth. You know, it had a droopy lip.
Fiberglass.
Because some guy had fixed it incorrectly in a fiberglass body.
But this was quite the search. Just someday there's a backstory just how the Lotus Elan came to life, because Jay didn't buy just the first Lotus Elan that came along. No, Jay made it into a full-on search for the right Lotus Elan.
Yeah, that was called the cheapest Lotus Elan.
Right. I wasn't going to put that out there, but yes.
Going right back to our quad story, graduation, after dark, our cars were so narrow they fit through a gate, and we had measured it up. We knew we could get through this gate and get onto the quad. Now, we graduated. What are they going to do, kick us out of high school? We're graduated, man. We're done. So Rick in a Bug Eye, myself in a Lotus Elan, Reese Libby in a Porsche Speedster, all three of us out onto that quad, and we are now racing through the quad like it was a Grand Prix course.
It was Le Mans, yeah.
We make a first lap. Now, this is after dark. The lights are on. First lap, second lap. I'm starting the third lap, and I look in my mirror, and I see four sets of lights. I see fourth. Who's joined us exactly? So I go a lap or two more, pull over to the side, and there's a Porsche that has joined us. Do you remember who belonged to that Porsche?
No.
That would be Mr. Delp, the boys' vice principal.
Oh, that's right.
He was the only sports car guy at Van Nuys High School at the time. He admired what we were doing. We were the sports car guys out in the parking lot. The rest was 57 Chevys. And I might add, Dale Pauldy, famous funny car driver. And all these other guys came with their hot rods. We were the guys with the Lotuses and the Bug Eye Sprites and the Porsches. And Mr. Delp, the boys' vice principal, tagged on to the end of our Grand Prix through the quad and said, guys, I'm not going to punish you. I can't punish you. Just don't do this again. Just go off the campus. I had a great time.
All right. Now, clearly some information got volunteered there.
Very true story, Spencer. Not a word made up.
I would have preferred my stepson not know, but here's the bottom line. Yes, there was a quad. And like all quads, there was where the popular kids sat. That's usually the quarterback of the football team and the head of the cheerleaders quad. And then, of course, there was all the A students hung out together and the rich kids hung out together, and then there was us, which before the word nerd or geek really existed, we were kind of the pre-emphasis of that. We were the beginning.
I don't know how to describe our little group, and I mean it was small. It might have been six or seven guys, maybe?
Pretty eclectic, but sports car guys, which, by the way, sports cars back then, when there's 57 Chevys jacked up in the parking lot, when there's Ratcliffe had a brand new Mustang when nobody else had anything even close. There were a lot of Plymouth and Chrysler products, all drag race oriented.
Yeah.
Sports cars, these little whiny little sports cars, these were not chick magnets, okay? In fact, these were chick repellent in terms of that. But we hung tight. We were the guys. We went to the road races on the weekends, and we had Jerry Titus, and nobody else did. You know what I'm saying?
If you couldn't keep up with why Jim Hall and Hap Sharp had a movable wing on their Can-Am car at lunch over sandwiches. If you couldn't keep up with that conversation, you were politely asked to leave.
Yes.
Please go over and go with the hot rod.
We had no conversation. Yeah. I reported. I moved to the Van Nuys High School during the first semester of high school, and I had a sports car graphic decal on my notebook, and I reported to gym class. Jay was if you can imagine this, a squad leader.
Once.
Had these, I think, four or five squads, and I was out there being introduced to the class, and somebody said, "Who wants this runt?" And there weren't many takers, but Jay saw the sports car graphic sticker and said, "I'll take them."
I'll gamble on that. Sort of kid over
the
there.
Puny guy.
Hi, what's your name? Rick Titus. Do you know Jerry Titus? Yeah, that's my dad.
Yeah.
Come with me.
You're in.
Come with me.
Since just that weekend they had seen us on the freeway coming away from Riverside Raceway,
and some of the stickers and so forth were still in the back window of the car. He was driving probably a press car. Who knows?
It was a BMW car.
A BMW. Yeah. And so I this is really ironic. I see Jerry Tyus driving home from a race at Riverside Raceway, and the next day, his kid's in my class. Well, what's going on here?
This you is know, all
I
good.
I couldn't believe it.
That led to 50 years of friendship.
Yeah.
That worked out pretty good.
I'm going to start the story, and it's going to go over the network break, so we'll have to find a time to stop it. But do you remember one of the very first race cars we did together?
If it starts with Subaru 360, yes.
And that is a Subaru 360. So for those of you out in the audience who have no idea what we're talking about, Subaru came to America with Malcolm Bricklin. Malcolm Bricklin imported 10,000 Subaru, what back then, if you were in Japan, they were known as the Subaru Ladybug was the name for it. It was a 360.
Really could have left that part out of the.
No.
This is a race car to you and me.
Looks like an egg.
It did look like an egg.
Very, very important. They built 400,000 of these vehicles in their day. They went 12 years as a model run. They had a 356cc engine, three-speed transmission, an inline two-cylinder, two-stroke engine. Do you remember it was a two-stroke?
Yep.
Two-stroke engine.
But it was injected.
Mounted, oil injected, so that was a big thing. Mix it all the time. Mounted transversely in the rear of the car.
Yep.
So it was kind of like a Beetle, but sort of a two-stroke Beetle, if you can imagine.
But half the size of a Beetle.
Half the size of a Beetle. Yeah. It was exactly 900 pounds curb weight, 70-inch wheelbase, 52 inches wide.
Yeah.
52 inches wide. Would you like to share with our audience how we got this race car to the tracks?
Okay. All right. First of all, what you need to know about this car is it actually came with casket handles on it, because if you crashed it, they were burying you in this puppy because there was no way to pull you out of it. All right. They could just drop you in the hole, then done. Yeah, we promoted this car out of Hart Toyota. God love them. Hart Toyota on Ventura Boulevard in Encino, California. Hart Toyota also became a Subaru franchise. This was Subaru's first entree from Fuji Heavy Industries becoming a car company.
1968.
Yep. And we conned them into letting us gut one of these things. And my father built a little sway bar for the front. We bought little Dunlop SP4 tires for it, put numbers on the side of it. And we needed a way to get it to the races, though.
Okay. With that, we better pause, get the brake out of the way, because there's far more to tell about the Subaru 360 race car.
Okay. Well, that's AMFM listeners. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Driver's Talk. Rick Titus, Jay Dalton, and of course Spencer Crick, who frankly, given that this is our Tall Tales episode, we decided to finally share some stories with you of our background and how we came up through this as kids and really landed in the middle of the automotive industry. I don't know that we knew that was going to happen then. Of course, Spencer will use all this as my stepson, and as a friend of Jay's will use this against us down the road, I'm quite confident. We were in the throes of a story how Jay and I finally got into the racing biz from behind the wheel ourselves, and that was we had conned a local Toyota and Subaru dealer to give us a Subaru 360, this little egg of a car, two-cylinder, because my father was famous, and we thought that made us famous. They should give us this little car and a way to transport it. It was the transporting that may have really emphasized, A, how truly ugly this little car was, and its size. They gave us, off their used car lot, a Chevrolet pickup truck. We went to the local hardware store and bought two 1x12s about 10 feet long, and we would drive this thing up into the bed on those pieces of wood, those 2x12s, and tie it down in the back of the Chevy pickup truck, and off to the slalom races we went.
No trailer needed.
No, we did not need a trailer, and the truck did not even know it was there.
Just a couple of things. Subaru 360 at the time retailed MSRP $1,297. Sold Hart probably had maybe a grand into it. Maybe a grand. Top speed 60 miles an hour. It weighed 900 pounds when we started, and then we gutted it. It was exempt from all the safety standards because it weighed less than 1,000 pounds. How's that?
Well, plus the fact that my father had a Trans Am team at the time that Jay and I basically hung out at, and it had all this cool equipment, allows us to build things.
Yeah.
So we had his crew fabricate a main hoop and back braces. So we had fairly talented guys building a little roll bar for this car. And then my father went down and bought some eye bolts, and we he bent a sway bar for it for the front, and we put some SP4s on him. We had ourselves a racing car.
So this was for the slalom circuit
yeah.
that used to thrive in Southern California. Parking lots cleared, some cones set up, timing equipment. You'd show up there and whatever you – they had a class for anything that
anything.
You showed up with.
Yep.
So suddenly
– except the Subaru 360.
Suddenly here comes in the stock car class,
yeah.
this stock-ish – Subaru 360, and it was very small wheelbase. Hey, we weren't going to go over 60 miles an hour anyway. Yep. We could turn a track that had to accommodate a Camaro with a little car gets pretty straight.
Yes.
If you can imagine.
You know what's his big advantage was this little size.
Little tiny size. Ricky, what was your best moment? I've got one.
Well, we went on to take that to driving school, SCCA driving school. So that was really my best moment. But the autocross thing was definitely fun, good practice.
Best thing for autocross for me was coming out of the last turn, Whiteman Airport parking lot.
Wow, forgot
last
about that.
Turn, lost the car in the last turn, spun it exactly around 180 degrees, never touched a cone because it was so small,
oh, that's right. You
threw
back
it in it. Reverse, went across the line backwards. Stopping the clock. No penalty.
Because if you hit a cone, they add a second or 3 seconds. I forget. I think it was 3 seconds. Autocrossing, still big to this day. Great way for people to play with their cars, get a little bit of car control experience, thing of nature. But I had forgotten all about you backing through the lights.
Yes, yes.
And quite dramatically, I might add.
Yeah,
and
with did flair.
Not, yeah, oh, absolutely. Went out with style. Went out with style. We took it all very seriously. It was our way to kind of break into racing. A little later on, Jay and I did, in fact, go to driver school that summer. That we both had to bring notes from our parents to participate because we were under 18. And I drove. Jay drove his Lotus Elan, as I recall.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, that was a faster car, needless to say. And of course, I had a Subaru 360, which essentially was the moving target. it weren't much.
Now, can I tell you? Can I recount something? This is a story about your dad. This is one of the Can-Am races that we went to at Riverside. He was racing for Chick Vandegrift at the time. He got into a Lola T70, brightly colored, if I remember. I believe it was blue and green, I think.
Yeah, actually, it was a McLaren. It was a...
McLaren or Lola? Yeah, McLaren?
McLaren. Mark 6B.
Mm-hmm. All right, here's the story I want to tell. He was really giving it his all. I can't remember where he was in the race at the time. But some guys kept hitting the tires, the half-buried tires that were... They were marked the apex of Riverside Raceway. Can you remember when there were buried tires marking an apex?
Yep.
Anyway, some of the tires came off, and Jerry ended up clipping one and kind of starting to take the nose off of this car, and it was slowly eroding during the race. Do you remember this day?
I do. I already go.
He finally comes in. He gets black flagged. The nose is kind of hanging off this car. They say, take the nose off. Well, no, you cannot go back out. The nose has to be on the car. So Jerry thinks that the car's retired. He gets out. The car gets pushed behind the wall. You and I go looking for a nose. Hey, somebody that's out. McLaren M6B. Nose.
Pete Revson, the Shelby entry.
Right. So here's, we've got, like, on a blue car, we've got a red nose. Stick the red nose on the car. Now, where's Jerry? Oh, Jerry's already in his street clothes. Yeah. Do you remember what I'm going to say next? So he goes, Jerry, get in the car. You've got to finish the race in this car so we can get the prize money. Got to get some prize money. So he puts on the top half of his uniform.
Top half of the driving suit.
Top half of the driving suit. He's in civilian clothes down below, like street shoes. Helmet, top half, gets back in, goes, finishes the race in the Can-Am car.
And you and I, we went up to Carroll ourselves, who obviously knew us, and because my father was driving for him and other stuff. We went up and said, if Pete Revson's out, we need that nose cone. And he looks at us a little baffled, and he goes, okay, so the crew pulls it off. We're running across this garage area.
With
the nose cone. We get this thing bolted on in front of my father's Can-Am car, and off he went and finished the race and got some prize money. So this did not help me on report card day, but it was still points worth getting. You know what I'm saying? It was all worth getting, but that was a good story. If you're going to go to those kind of stories, then I've got to take you to Riverside 1966, the Trans Am race in which my father was brought in to drive a one-week-old Mustang that had been built to make sure Ford won the championship. At that juncture, Barracuda... Team Starfish.
Carroll sent some guy to the dealership, said, go get a car right now at the beginning of the week.
Yeah.
By the end of the week, it was at Riverside.
Yep.
And it turned out well.
It did turn out well. Jay and I are there. And 1966 Riverside Trans Am, it's a 3 or 4 hour event. Most of the teams had two drivers. My father wanted all the prize money, so he said, I'll drive it by myself, no problem. practiced the car very little. Car had been built by a very talented crew that he worked with before. And, of course, he puts it on the pole. They do a Le Mans start. Now, this is about pretty much the end of the Le Mans start era. But Jay and I are behind the fence where the cars are all lined up. Of course, we're lined up behind my father's car. Bang, the gun goes off. The driver's all raced across. My father's one of the fastest guys to get to his car and proceeds to flood it. We could literally hear him pumping the pedal from where we were standing.
While the rest of the field left.
It was the lone car sitting there. He drives the thing off to...
Finally gets it started. In gear it goes.
Goes.
Last car. Into turn nine. Yep. Last car. And we're just thinking, maybe we... Yeah.
Who knows?
Where's the hot dogs?
Yep. This. By halfway, he's leading the whole race. He's leading it. We think, awesome, he's going to win this Trans Am race. He hits one of those tires again that had come loose.
Those half-buried tires, yes.
And it knocked the oil filter off this car at turn two. He drove it from turn two with all this blue smoke coming out of it all the way back. Riverside at that time was 2.5 miles long. Drives it back to the pits. Again, he thinks he's done. Undoes the belts. Gets out. He's talking to Chris Economaki, who was head of sports broadcasting back then. And, of course, figures it's done. He's got a cigarette lit. Carol's standing there.
National Speed Sport News. Yeah, you want to give Chris his due.
Oh, absolutely. Plus, I think ABC was covering the race. Doing this interview, the crew screws on another oil filter, fills the engine full of engine, and says, Jerry, back in. Gets back in this thing. And drives it all the way back to the front again and wins that race. Wins the championship for Ford Motor Company, wins the prize money for himself. And Jay and I are in Victory Circle with my father, with this very attractive Indian adorned lady, a Western Indian, American Indian adorned lady, is up on the roof with my father, the car, champagne's flying, it's all good stuff, it's a great thing. And my father, being quite the mercenary that he was, Jay and I are like, kiss her, do swap some tongue, do something for us. Vicariously, we're living through you right now.
We're 18.
Come on, this is the moment, dude. Don't disappoint us, right? Says, yeah, well, this is all fine and good. Where's my check? All about the utilitarian. Let's just go to the facts. I'm here for my money. So that was a pretty good time, a great experience for us. And
hey, we've got a couple minutes, but let's fast forward just for a second. You want to get into the Celine, couple of the Celine days? Have you got a story or two about
Celine?
No,
I got to rat you out. You think? But I got to rat you out on the King Cobra. So when we come back.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, the King Cobra.
My father
drives
this abomination for Shelby called a King Cobra, designed by Len Terry out of England. Car was a total disaster. My father ends up buying this puppy just because he wants to strip some parts off of it. After just two races, they decide this thing hasn't got a future. Buys it, brings it home, sitting in our backyard. Well, not a lot of people have, especially our age, have a Can-Am car backed by Ford Motor Company and Shelby American.
So Jay, sitting in the garage
sitting
at home.
At home. And my stepmother at the time, who was, I think, 12, and, of course, had a cooking repertoire of mac and cheese and hot dogs, was making, mac and cheese, and Jay was saying for dinner. But he asked my dad, is it okay if I get in the car and sit in the car? Yeah, go right ahead. Yeah, fine. But Jay couldn't just sit in the car. He had to do all the belts, which was a clip-in style rotary release. Kind of unusual. That was sort of the new trend at that juncture. Jay gets in the car. The belts went on due. My stepmother got off her broom long enough to announce that dinner was, in fact, prepared, and we went on in to eat. Jay stuck in the car. We're sitting inside, and all we hear from now and then, Mr. Titus.
I can't get out of the seatbelt.
I can't get out.
Now, this is both stupid and not stupid at the same time. Of course I know how to undo the latch, and the stupid latch wouldn't undo the belts. It's known as a doorbell latch. You've got to turn it. You don't lift it up. It isn't an over-center latch. It's a doorbell thing. You've got to turn this thing. Turn it. I kept turning it, and it wouldn't undo it. I'm sitting in there. They're eating dinner. Mr. Titus, I can't get out of
your
car.
He's yelling this. And my father couldn't take it any longer because the urgency and the how pathetic his voice sounded just grew with every recall, right? And finally, my stepmother goes, Jerry, really? So my father goes out and helps him with that. I think they had to take a screwdriver or something, take it apart.
We undid the belts. And you don't know the punchline to the story.
Oh, I do know, unfortunately.
The punchline to the story is, you know, I must have just saved your life,
Mr.
Jerry.
I think I saved your life.
Just saved now. Your life because this guy got stuck in the
You know, belt. Go out swinging. Hey, AMFM listeners, we'll be right back. More from Tall Tales when we return. And welcome back to Driver's Talk. Rick Titus, Jay Dalton, and Spencer Crick. What we are in the middle of is the Tall Tales episode of Driver's Talk. They're tall tales because they really flash back on the better than 50 years that Jay and I have been friends. We've had a lot of life experiences together. usually surrounded around motorsports or the automobile in nature, literally since high school, when we've known each other since the 10th grade. Having said that, we were sharing different, what at the time now seem comical, experiences, but they were also great experiences. We went through driver school together in 1969, I believe, 68 or 68. Danny McKeever was my instructor. He ended up being a teammate that worked with us at Saline for one of the endurance races, one of the 24-hour races we were involved in. And, of course, we've known Danny for a very long, long time. One of the things about great just growing up in motorsports, and I really think it would be great for kids today, and that is, it gave you something to be involved in, and something now you could even future generate a career in, Jay, to be fair.
Well, it's certainly far more organized than it was back then.
Right.
We, in high school, if you followed motorsports, I can remember having to go down to the newsstand and buy a newspaper on Monday morning to get the Grand Prix results.
Right.
This was like, you know, it might as well have been smoke signals.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't really know what was going on.
That's true.
And we'd pick up a newspaper before Monday morning's high school class and to find out that Dan Gurney just won the Belgian Grand Prix
in a car of his own design.
In his own car. Yeah. You know, things like that. It was a real different period of time. We felt quite out there.
Oh, it was definitely not the in crowd. I agree.
No. This was not ordinary by any stretch of the imagination.
But we weren't troubled kids. We weren't in trouble. You know, we didn't have police reports. We'd never, you know, done anything. We didn't out drinking. We weren't out smoking the magic stuff. And, you know, it was a great group of guys who grew up around, to be perfectly honest.
I want to tell you, the biggest trouble that we had was dealing with who would be lost each year to this sport.
Yeah.
Whether it was the guys at Indianapolis or the guys in the Grand Prix.
Yep.
Sooner or later, you lost somebody that you were following, that you were really caring about. Those were the terrible moments that we had to go through.
The dangerous times, yeah. To be honest with you.
Yeah.
So here we are, a couple of high school graduates, and, of course, we get an opportunity to go on tour with my father's Trans Am team. Now, we weren't much more than glorified, if you will, wheel polishers and errand guys, but here we were, two teenagers. We're on the crew of a legitimate factory-backed Pontiac Trans Am team. And, of course, we absorbed all of this as best we possibly could. Joining us, I might add, right down pit road was Edsel Ford, also polishing wheels as a teenager. We've gone on to know Edsel since, as he's now chairman of the board of Ford Motor Company, but grew up in the same league, same things. We're at Mid-Ohio, which was one of the prettiest racetracks, coming from California, where most of the racetracks were a little deserty, to actually go to Mid-Ohio, where they had grass and trees and pretty paving and some buildings, though not as fancy as it is today. It was a big opportunity for us, and Jay and I, coming from gas station work, now all of a sudden we're involved with the Trans Am team, are actually out at on Friday's practice. We're actually standing right out at the very, very edge of the pit wall, where we could watch the cars go right by. And I'll never forget, Jay had a rag stuck in a red rag in each pocket, back pocket. And we're out there, and my father comes out of the last corner and actually drops the rear wheels off the track. The car's fairly crossed up, but he never still upshifts to fourth gear, comes by us essentially sideways. I'm holding a board out. He salutes the board, straightens the car out, makes a corner. I turn around, and all I see are these two red rags stuck in the draft of Jay hauling buns for the pits.
I had less confidence.
Yeah, that the rescue was going to occur. Jay did not want to be a participant in any kind of crash. So all I saw was the bottom of Jay's feet and these two rags just dwindling in the wind there.
Now, for those of you listening very, very closely, I want to make just a tiny correction there. Edsel is not the chairman of the board. Bill Ford is the chairman
of
the board.
That's right.
And Edsel has another board purpose seat at Ford, and yeah. I'm sure I can't figure out what he does.
Yeah, he is on the board of directors. Excuse me. Yeah.
Nevertheless. Hey, so then fast forward a few years, and you end up getting a ride with Saline.
Yep.
With the Saline Mustangs. Now, back then,
now, that's a racing slang for means you're a driver now for a team. We refer to it as having a ride.
In an Endurance Cup series where there were 4-hour, 6-hour races, and as the series went on, it became to be some 24-hour races as well.
The long ones, yeah.
This is a bit of a dream come true, because here we are. We're racing Mustangs. We're on a team that at least presents itself fairly well out there. And after 1 year of sort of messing around and getting a lot of things wrong, by 86... we're kind of like in there, sponsored by General Tires. We're up towards the front of the grid. It's expanded to a 3-car team.
Yep.
We've got some notable drivers in the other cars. And usually it was Rick and Steve Saline in one car.
Mm-hmm.
That was one pairing, and then there were a few others. but just little tricks to the car that weren't commonly known at that time. First, we couldn't get the brakes to live very well.
No.
The brakes, the calipers kept canting on their mounts, so it would wear unevenly. It would wear in a triangle instead of a flatly wear down the pads. So these are kind of rubberized mounts that that were holding on these calipers. So suddenly got the bright idea. Let's put some valve guides in there, some bronze valve guides. Tap, 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 in go the bronze valve guides. I'm sure they were completely illegal. Never found. In 3 years, never found them. The other little trick that we used to do was, because these were escort, essentially stock-based cars, mm-hmm. is that I ran the pits, and Ricky was the lead, the second driver behind Steve. So I had to coordinate how to get the cars refilled as quickly as possible, yep. using a stock gas cap. Now, you know what a stock gas cap works like. You turn it a couple of turns, and then it goes click, 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 and now you're done. All right, well, we figured this is not going to work. This costs us too much time. So we started grinding down the threads on this cap. So it would go in, half a turn, click, gone. Of course, completely illegal. Ironically, on all three cars, on the last stop of each race, dang, that refueler would drop the gas cap on the ground. He would just fumble it and drop that gas cap, and out of his pocket would come a completely legal stock gas cap, so that when the cars went to impound, they had a perfectly normal, perfectly sized cap. But throughout the race, we were gaining seconds with these trick caps. No one ever caught it.
No, it was very, very, very good. I'll tell you, it was so interesting to be racing in a series that has so many factory-backed cars. Ours were from Ford Motor Company. Chevy had Camaros there. There were Corvettes from the factory there. There were Mitsubishi Starions and it, just about everything. Porsche 944s, which was one of our main nemesis from Porsche. And, of course, it was creative thinking. That's the word I'm going to go with, Jay. There was creative thinking in all these key factory cars to make them, well, essentially faster than people who showed up with just base stock cars. That was not the way to go.
One of the high points of my life, August 1988, we're at Mossport. We always did terrifically well at Mossport. I think we won all three times we were there.
Yep.
But in 88, we had a three-car team and won Mossport. This is the 24 hours of Mossport, and finished first, second, and third.
Yep.
In a 24-hour race with a three-car team. I flew home thinking to myself, I'm sorry, I can't best that.
No, that's
that's about as high as you can go in our world at the time.
Most work is in Canada. I talked to Jackie Stewart one time, and I said, name the scariest racetrack in all the world. And he goes, oh, easy, Mossport, Canada. Mm-hmm. And I had to kind of agree with him because it was pretty terrifying. So one track where you did come around every lap and go, whew, made it that time. Scary place. Of course, it always rained. And they loaned, the crowd could take free firewood. The problem is it was some smoky tree, and the thing would just, the back straight would just get buried in the smoke. You had to turn the driving lights off literally to go up this back straightaway that basically wasn't entirely straight, but an interesting place, extremely challenging, very, very fast, only one third gear corner on the entire course. Everything else was fourth and fifth, and most of the corners were blind commitment.
Fast. Usually a little fog gets into the mix,
yep.
and usually a little rain gets into the mix.
Because God has a sense of humor.
So if 88 was the high point, I've got to tell you, remind you, in fact, you might have been in the car. You may not have even remembered when this happened. But it's the middle of the night, 24-hour race. It's about 2:33 in the morning. We're at Mossport. I think this might have been 87. And the crew directly in front of us, directly next to us,
I know what you're
comes
gonna say.
In a Porsche
yeah.
and leaves with the nozzle in the car, pulling their gas rig over and flooding the pit lane with all the pit boxes and all the grandstands, which were wood at the time, mm-hmm. flooding them with gas. And you know that moment when you go into slow motion and you think, I better be really careful here.
Yeah.
These are the moments when,
Ooh,
I don't know what's going to happen next.
Yep.
And it was one of those moments. It did not catch fire, but there was gas everywhere. They had to stop the race, red flag the race, clean up the pit lane. Nothing caught fire. But, man, we could have been gone.
Yeah, that would have been ugly. That would have been truly ugly. A lot of fueling going on at that time. So having said that, we're going to go to break right now. We'll be back with more of Tall Tales. And welcome back to Driver's Talk. Rick Titus, Jay Dalton, and Spencer Crick, who I noticed, Jay, has been taking notes on this so that he can blackmail us down the road. I'm scared, Spencer. You're not going to use this stuff against us, are you? Yeah, that's exactly what I was afraid of. I knew this was not a good idea. We've had we've really been blessed in that we have such a diverse automotive background. Just to kind of change pace here, Jay, I'm going to kind of rat us out on something. Jay and I do a lot of vehicle testing, highly measured, highly certified, over witnessed, if you will, usually by the company's legal department.
Validation
stuff. It usually is direct comparison to the competition on Ford Motor Company's behalf. To do that, we had to go get what they call a Tier 3 testing license.
We did 8 years ago.
Yeah, this was, and being a professional race driver, I thought a Tier 3 would be pretty good. Then we have a mutual friend that works with us who told us, TJ Durst said, yeah, I just took it. You guys are going to be surprised. It's a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. So we went to the proving grounds to ride with their key licensing and certifying guy. And we're in Mustangs and Tauruses, and we didn't know they were going to wet down the entire...
Well, it was raining that day.
It was raining, good point.
The wet portion of their test.
We both managed to get this Tier 3 that day after a few spins and a few moments, but we did pull it off. And then we find out later there's only 93 of them worldwide that have Ford Motor Company employees that have a Tier 3 license. And then we found out what a Tier 3 allows you to do. I was not entirely thrilled when I heard this. It allows us to go 160 miles an hour. That's our speed limit. Oh, to failure. It was the to failure part that troubled me, Jay.
I always say it allows me to go 160 without asking.
Yeah, right. Forget about the failure. Failure part. I don't really want 160 mile an hour failure. I guess we're equipped to deal with it, but no thank you. I was proud of the fact that we both pulled that off. I mean, here's a couple of we had an auto shop teacher that referred to us as Yardbirds in high school. Here's two Yardbirds and now are Tier 3 test licenses, two of 93 in the entire world. But yeah, we can test anywhere in the world on a Ford Motor Company test facility. And by the way, we're one of the very few subcontractors that actually have that license because we're not employees of Ford. So
yeah, that always surprises them. They say, so what's your Ford employee number? Well, no, we're Tier 1 suppliers, and you have a
Tier
license?
Three.
Tier 3? What's going on here? Anyway, enough of that one.
Yeah.
I've got a couple of them that I wanted to bring up. As long as we're talking about OEs, I've got one that strangely jumps to present day.
OE stands for original manufacturer.
Originally, equipment manufacturers, yep. the manufacturers from Detroit or Dearborn. All my career, I've been told about the special shapes of the pop rivets that hold on the vehicle identification plates that are on the dashboard of cars.
Oh, I didn't know this. Yeah, I don't know.
You
this
do
story.
Know that they have a special shape. They have a six-sided shape or a five-sided shape,
oh,
depending on the
this.
Manufacturer.
Yeah.
And I've always been told in years past that if you are ever caught in the factory as a worker with one of those pop rivets,
oh,
you're set down. You are jailed.
No, well, it
because
makes sense.
Why on earth would you ever need a rosette pop rivet,
yeah,
if you weren't changing VIN numbers or somehow forging something or making something that you shouldn't be? Now, I've heard that all my life. But, of course, along comes the interwebs, and now we're in a whole new world. Because, Ricky, here is the ad out of eBay, out of Russia.
Out of
that
Russia.
That you can buy your rosette VIN number rivets.
Wow.
To put your rivets on. I'm not actually doing the advertisement for this guy. If you buy these pop rivets, I'm convinced that this is an FBI sting.
Yeah, because we're talking about a federal crime here.
Yeah,
we're
this not, is a federal crime.
This is not a local
source. So on the western border of Russia, near Ukraine, just above the Black Sea, almost above Turkey there, in the bay of the Sea of Azov, is this guy selling these rosette pop rivets. Why on earth would you want those, Rick? If you weren't stealing cars.
I was going to say, if you borrowed a car from someone and you wanted to put a different VIN.
I don't know. But that's fast forwarding to today, a story that I had heard for a long, long time.
I had not heard that. That's kind of interesting what goes on there.
Part of the...
I'm with you. I wouldn't order them.
No, it's a sting. I guarantee you it's a sting. Can I tell you about the fastest wet lap ever recorded at Indianapolis?
Whoa. I don't even know about this either. Is this on the road
this
course?
This is the Indy 500.
Yeah.
The fastest wet lap that should be the first wet red flag.
Yeah, it's large.
The fastest red lap, because they don't ever run
in the wet.
In the wet at Indianapolis on the high-speed oval. So one of those days in the month of May, when it used to be a month-long deal, you know.
Right.
So it was a practice day, and I know this because a friend of mine ended up being a crew chief on one of the teams and so forth. He was from South Africa. And he said, well, why don't we have some fun? So they took the telemetry out of their car, went to the start-finish line, hung over the side of the pit wall at the start-finish line, and passed their telemetry box in front of the machine, in front of the pickup,
in front of the scanner that's embedded
at the start-finish line.
Yeah.
So he passes it over, looks at his watch, tick, 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 tick. All right, 40 seconds later, passes it over again, and their car number goes to the top of the pylon.
Yes.
No cars are on the track.
I love it.
Absolutely a true story. And they continued doing it for a while. And they got their car right up at the top, so they were the fastest car of the day.
In the wet.
In the wet. There was no cars that ran that day.
See, what worries me is that they start getting competitive. I think I could do it in 39.9.
39.9, 39.8. Anyway.
Keep dropping that record. I think that's pretty.
That's an awful long time ago. That was in the 90s when telemetry first really started up.
Yep.
And you could do shenanigans like that. But I do think that that was a fantastic way to initiate the speedway.
Well, hang on. I just bought a little race car that has that kind of transponder in it.
Yeah.
And maybe you should sit on the pit wall and I complete a lap or two more than I actually did. I don't know. Kind of interesting, though. They're registered now in the whole deal, so it's pretty strict science. You know, we really were fortunate to be involved with Saleen during those years. We went on to win the tire manufacturer championship, the car manufacturer championship, the team championship, and the driver championship. Four championships, one season. Had an opportunity to be with great, great teammates, Parnelli Jones, George Fulmer, Pete Halsmer, Scott Pruitt, Skeeter McKitterick, Desiree Wilson, Steve Saleen.
Parnelli Jones.
That's what I said, yeah.
Yeah.
Talented guys that, certainly kept me honest. I mean, you really had to be quick or you weren't there anymore.
Let me tell you, I'm sorry, this is just old remembrances.
Yeah.
Can I remind you of a Monday morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, very early, down in the basement of the Peterson Publishing Company, and up comes, we made the Saleen car arrive and your dad's old car arrive.
Yep.
And we made Carol Shelby arrive.
That's right.
And Carol, lo and behold, there's this picture that made the front page of the Mustang magazine, monthly
sports car magazine,
Mustang
Monthly. Yeah.
Mustang Monthly of Steve, you, and Carol and all the cars duplicating that championship 20 years to the day.
It worked out pretty good.
Unbelievable.
There was some pressure on that one, folks. I'm not going to fib to you. That was my father had started his to win this championship in 67 at Sebring by winning the first four-hour race there. We ended our championship there by winning the six-hour. Well, we didn't win the race. One of the cars did. One of the Saleen cars. The car I was in, the car that needed to win the championship, actually came in fifth, as I recall.
So we get started in this crazy radio show and the middle of January 2000 in Bakersfield. And along the lines, you know, we get to interview some pretty darn famous people, including you got to interview one of your heroes, Jackie Stewart.
Jackie Stewart, yep.
And I got to interview one of my heroes, Dan Gurney.
Yep.
But along the line came Ivan Stewart. And he told Ivan Stewart was Iron Man Ivan Stewart, famed for off-road racing champion. I don't know how many times, dozens of times.
And
a Toyota fixture at the time. Now, we're almost running out of time here, but
no, we got 12.
Do you remember the story he told about wearing the catheter?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
These off-road guys will wear a catheter, so if they have to urinate, it goes down a tube, goes down his pant leg, and it exits the car because the cars have holes in the floorboard, so it'll just exit right now. Well, he's the Iron Man. He doesn't get a driver replacement. He's got to go the whole way down Baja. So, I mean, he's going to go to the bathroom. So, before the race began, they're in Ensenada. He's in the lavatory. He's in the lavatory with a couple of other guys, you know, standing there. And Iron Man Ivan Stewart puts his right leg up on the urinal. And
his driving shoe is
catheter,
literally on the urinal.
He is urinating into the urinal out of his pant leg.
Out of his driving shoe.
Because he's ready to race. He's racing in 10 minutes, you know? And as he leaves the place, he overhears one guy say to the other guy, "Why do you think they call him Iron Man?"
Yeah, that was a funny story. He is a good cat,
loved
too.
Loved
yeah, no, good guy. We've had Lutz on, Bob Lutz, Robert Lutz.
Oh, it's a parade. Yeah. To be honest, I'm a little embarrassed. There's probably 50 household word names,
yep.
You know, household names that we have had on this radio broadcast. We've been very blessed.
Got to remind you about the, of course, when we talked to Andy Granatelli. Andy Granatelli had written a great book. They call me Mr. 500. He was obviously the captain of STP, and, you know, he won the Indy 500 with Mario driving, and then he brought the turbine cars and with Parnelli driving, and he really did a lot of things, and he really was the speedway in a lot of ways. But he had written this book, and we were fortunate enough to have reprint copies. But we asked him one question. We could have left and gone to lunch. Come back, and he'd still be talking. But he was just a plethora of amazing stories of crazy things that he did with his brother growing up, and just some of the trouble they got into and the kind of things that they would try.
And drive the race car to Indianapolis from his home, in Chicago, was it?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah.
Nevertheless,
it was
a terrific interview. It had to be highly edited because he just went on and on and on. Andy Granatelli has passed away a few years ago. I was really sad to hear that, but he was one of the craziest interviews we ever did. Rick, in the last few seconds, I just want to thank you for having me on this show for so many years.
I love doing it.
I've enjoyed it completely. And this has been Tall Tales.
Tall Tales.
It came from an idea of a friend of ours by the name of Don and his wife, Diane. Thanks, Don, for the suggestion.
Yeah, good idea. That said, we wish you open roads and safe motoring. Y'all take care.